FBI Studios. This is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Roth. I know it's been a long wait, but today is the day. You finally get to hear the final hour of my conversation with Jim. In all honesty, I was hoping for a miracle from him. This scene is so complex and confusing, I was wishing for one of those classic Jim Clemente lightbulb moments. But unfortunately, with this case, even Jim is unsure of what happened on the night of the murders. And that's what makes profiling this case so particularly difficult. Profiling is the analysis of the behaviors demonstrated by the unknown offenders. Put more clearly, we have to know what happened before we can know who the offender is. In this case, you're going to hear Jim and I agree on several elements of the crime scene activities, and that's helpful and will begin to shape our profile. But on the other hand, we see two different possible series of events during the commission of the crime. We both acknowledge that either scenario is possible, and we tend to lean in different directions. And that, of course, leads us to two different profiles, either of which could be accurate. At the end of this conversation, we take the elements that we both agree on and compare them to known persons of interest in the case. It was a long road to get here, but in the end, we finish with what I think are some relevant and useful insights. This is Season 12, Episode 11, Jim Clemente, Part 3.
Texas Ranger James Holland is a legendary interrogator. They call him the serial killer whisperer.
You can't hide those indications, and that's why yesterday I knew that you did it.
But now, shocking interrogation tapes reveal how the super cop really operates.
And that's why they asked me to come in, because I'm special.
From Something Else, The Marshall Project, and Sony Music Entertainment, this is Smokescreen. Just say you're sorry. Listen and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And I know you keep leaning towards Becky being the target. I just keep having, and I'm tracking with you, I'm having a hard time getting there because when I'm looking at, so like the way they were killed, Vicky, gun to the head, pressed against her head, pulls the trigger. Becky, if she was shot, is shot lower left abdomen.
Abdomen? Oh, I thought her chest was what was gone.
Well, it was chest and abdomen is what's gone. And it's part of her chest, a little bit of the left side of her chest. So, like, you could have probably hit the left lung, like the edge of the part of the left lung that burned away. That's possible. But it's, you know, so, if I'm pissed off at Becky, I shoot Becky one time center of body mass. But then her mom, who I have no beef with, if Becky's the target, I hold a gun to her head and blow her brains out. I have a hard time connecting those. It's the fire on the wheelbarrow keeps taking me to where you're at, that there's something different there. Mm-hmm. But I can't place in my mind whether it's because she was the target or it's because she was the interruption that wasn't part of the plan.
Right. So as I wrote this down, I got to the point where I said two offenders, not criminally sophisticated, not forensically too sophisticated, planned, but not very well planned. And then there's two possibilities: target mom, target Becky. Mm-hmm. It's a bifurcated process at that point. And all I'm saying is, what was actually accomplished with the mom? She was left where she died. There was no indication that she was tied up or tortured or made to suffer. Was she just put out of her misery? Boom, boom, practical kills, double shot to the father, stepfather or whatever, one shot to the head to the mom. But Becky got this special treatment. She got this over the top, very bizarre. And is that because, one, she surprised them and ruined their plans? Two, she surprised them and ran away and then caused them to have to run after her. And that's why she got this special treatment. I don't know. You know, I would have really liked a more detailed analysis of what happened to her. I mean, I have to say that there's the determination that she was dead before she was burned is interesting. And I want to know how they knew that. Like, how was that determination made?
It was essentially because there was no indication of her inhaling any superheated gases, smoke, anything like that. Nothing in the airway to indicate that she was breathing when she was lit on fire. And that's when I go back to what was done to her was extreme, but it was just part of the concealment, right? It was post-mortem.
Yeah, but why are we concealing her? Why are we trying to conceal her to the extent that, you know, when there is a big, bad burning house 50 feet away or 70 feet away, like, why is it that they couldn't get those 70 feet with her body? One could be because you had a male and female pair who were doing this and the female didn't have the strength to carry her and the male was too busy lighting the fire inside. I don't know. Or, you know, or it just could be that you have a weaker or lazier person. I don't know. But for some reason, they didn't put her in the house with the rest of them. They burned her outside. They made the special effort to pour accelerant on her and light her on fire in what had to be a very public way. And that's just so different for me, especially when you have the burning house right next door. Right there.
And she's in a device with a wheel on it.
Yes.
Like you could get her to the house easily. And we know that when she was lit on fire, the house wasn't burning to the extent that they couldn't get her inside. It was, you know, even when the neighbor got there, it wasn't burned to the extent that they couldn't get her inside.
Right. So they, you know, they may have had a couple of minutes to know that the neighbor was coming, a couple of minutes to know that the fire department was coming. And so they had to make a decision at that last second, pour the gas on her, light it there, and not put her inside.
Could it be, too, that you have two different personalities? Like maybe, like, so say she walked in on it, interrupted it. One of the guys chases her down, shoots her, and now she's laying there dead. And guy one, the guy who maybe is more criminally sophisticated, is going to light the fire in the house, says to take care of her, and the other guy comes up with a plan to throw her in a wheelbarrow and light her on fire. They're just two different guys doing two different things at the same time.
Yeah.
She feels like to me, and I know that it's completely opposite from the way you feel about it. But to me, like everything to me feels like she was a complete afterthought. Like she didn't matter. They shot her one time, sent her a body mass.
Why wouldn't they just leave her on the ground and pour gasoline all over her and then take off? I mean, why put her in a wheelbarrow? What does that accomplish?
Well, I mean, practically, the thing is, I don't know that someone would know this.
Right. That it was a good place to burn somebody. Right.
It's the best place to burn somebody is in that, which is what that coupled with the fire starting location was leaning me towards someone in like emergency services, someone who has an idea of response times, has an idea of how to, you know, how the fire might behave, but, you know, in certain ways.
So we'll add to that list somebody who is not only a potential police or military trained and experienced person, but we can also add somebody who is a firefighter. And, you know, I mean, you know, who starts fires?
Firefighters often do.
All right. And people who like to see big things happen with a little match and want to feel better about themselves and want to make a big splash, want to cause all this problem. You know, had they not lit the house on fire, had they not burned her in this wheelbarrow, what would have happened? They might have found some forensic evidence of the persons who did this.
Right. It probably wouldn't have gone unsolved for 10 years.
Probably would have been more. Yeah.
And so that's what I keep coming back to with Becky is if there was a physical struggle by burning, whether that was the intention or not, by burning her, they burned away any chance of recovering any physical evidence off of her.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, the question is whether they knew that or not, because it was effective in doing it.
At the same time, they would have had many hours of more time to do whatever the fuck they wanted to do if they never lit the fire in the first place. So,
right.
You know, this, the fire at the same time that it helped them maybe forensically hurt them criminally, hurt their escape, hurt their ability to finish what they were doing. So it was counterproductive to a great degree. And in the end, you know, you said there was arrest made, but I don't know anything about that at this point. And
yeah, well, I should point out, I forgot to mention at the beginning, one thing that Jim never wants to know coming into this is who the suspects are, or who was arrested for it. So he has no idea about any of that right now.
No, I mean, all that does is put you down a path of bias. And you know, I'm trying to avoid that. But, you know, Bob, you know, I know when you explained this to me the first time, you know, I was like, what? You know, it's very bizarre. And I'd like to stay away from extreme explanations for things, you know. I like to stay as clean and as, you know, sort of simple as possible. And the fact that that wheelbarrow has a wheel is important to me. And so I think that it was used to move her from point A to point B, point A being the place where she was killed and point B being where they intended to put her, but got interrupted. And I just can't see a practical reason to put her right there at that spot and then burn her. There doesn't seem to be a rational reason for that. Now, in the heat of the moment, in the midst of committing a heinous crime, somebody may have lost their ability to think rationally, and this might have seemed like a good idea, or as I believe, somebody was basically interrupted in the middle of doing what they intended to do with her.
Right. And see, the things that I struggle with the wheelbarrow are the area they call the area of disturbance, which is where the wheelbarrow's tracks start. They kind of lead back to this area, and then the dirt scuffled up there. Her shoe's not found there. So if the shoe came off in a struggle there, the offender took that with them. There's no blood anywhere back there. That's one area they did very detailed, take tons of photos and look all over the ground for any kind of evidence, and found no indication of any blood. One area they didn't look, at least it's not in any of the reports and there's zero photos of it, is in the path between the back door and the house. So for me, kind of part of process of elimination came from maybe she was shot while running down that path. They got trampled by firefighters and whatever, and they just never looked. But then it comes back to get the interruption. I'm just trying, I try to, you know how I do is kind of what you've taught. I walk through those crime scenes and try to put myself in that position. And so you roll in this wheelbarrow. You've gone all the way from 200 yards back in the desert to now you're 20 yards from the house. It's downhill to the house and you get interrupted. You think, oh shit.
Well, if you see headlights coming around the corner, you just stop cold, right?
Right. But so you stop cold. And you're frazzled now, so you drop the body, like stop the wheelbarrow, run up to the house or wherever, get some accelerant, go back to the wheelbarrow, pour that on it, light it on fire.
Or
to me, it would make more sense that they would, oh shit, either just dump her and leave her, or continue what you were already doing and run up to the house and throw her in.
Yeah, but
get
if,
out of there.
If you're, you know, you chase her back there and kill her somewhere between the house and the back somewhere, and you realize, I'm not going to carry that body all the way back here. So you go grab the wheelbarrow and bring the accelerant with you and dump her body in it and start to bring it back to the house. It's very convoluted, but you know, maybe they weren't thinking so straight and they just said, yeah, well, this is what I'm going to do.
Yeah. And I acknowledge that's a distinct possibility, maybe even a probability. I just like the fact you said it's so convoluted, the things that have to fit together for that to work makes me lean towards that she just died by the wheelbarrow and they threw her in and lit her on fire.
It's possible.
As opposed to going back to the bed. Because the other thing that gets me is the lack of wheelbarrow tracks going to it.
Well, yeah, but, and like I said, the wheelbarrow may have been out to the back, you know.
It was already there.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think that either way, the wheelbarrow had to have already been back there, whether it was back there and they rolled up with some trees and it was just sitting there, or if they killed her back there, put her in
it. But
back.
Yeah, they're bringing him back. He sees the lights, so he hears the siren. He drops her there. He runs into the garage, grabs a can, pours it on her, lights the match. Let's get the fuck out of here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that just to me is like, that's expedient. And it takes into account the fact that there was an interruption. And that interruption, they acted quickly and got out of Dodge.
So if we work that scenario out, that they did, she was killed back there. Does that still fit with her being the target, and how does that play out? If she's the target and they kill her back, do you think they still killed John and Vicky first, or they killed her out back, came to the house, killed John and Vicky, then went back?
Nah, I think they got interrupted when they were dealing with her, I think John and Vicky were killed first.
Doesn't that lean towards them being the target, you think?
Unless they were planning on sitting there and waiting until she came home.
Okay, yeah, so just kill them and sit and wait. And then she ended up being home sooner.
Yes.
But either way, I think one area that we agree on is that this was a planned homicide.
Yeah, I don't think this was an accident or got out of control. They bought the weapons for a reason. And, you know, they may not have been the best, most efficient way to do what they were doing, but that goes to their lack of sophistication, criminal sophistication.
Right. So I want to tell you a little bit, if we're kind of, it's going to break down real quick where we kind of agree and disagree about profile, then I'll give you some a little suspect information, because I want to hear what you think about that. So we both agree it was planned, that the intention here was homicide.
Mm-hmm.
We both agree that John wasn't the target,
yeah.
That it was either Becky or Vicky were targeted right. Here.
We do.
I agree with you that there's some indications of someone with possible military, police, fire, some sort of emergency service background. From there, with those things that we kind of all agree on, those three, who do you think, if you were to tell the police, who would you go be looking for?
Well,
or type of person, I mean, you should be looking for.
Yeah, well, because they're not particularly criminally or forensically sophisticated, because there's such a hodgepodge of things that they did. I believe it's two people, the two weapons, as well as the weird, different, conflicting behavior.
Mm-hmm.
The lack of evidenced motive of, you know, home invasion, robbery, drug revenge kill, or anything like that leads me to believe that there is a personal cause that motivated this, and therefore the actual motive was murder. In other words, when you say, when we agree on the fact that it was planned, that the plan, there are multiple things that could be planned. You know, bringing a gun to a house because you heard they have money and you want to get their money because they're a customer of yours and they haven't paid you. You know, there's a lot of things that could happen. But the ultimate goal is that these three people were murdered and there's no real indication of other crimes that were committed, no rape, no robbery, no burglary, at least not that could be determined based on, you know, the condition of the house. So I'd be looking for somebody who spent time with Becky's body because Becky was important for them to conceal, that they either had a known relationship with or had a scheduled reason to be together. You know, they're, again, typically people who stage crime scenes, you know, and this is sort of a quasi stage scene. In other words, you kill somebody, you want to hide the fact that you killed somebody, so you burn down the house, and maybe people are going to think they just perished in the fire. But then you leave somebody burning outside, clearly in a way that
right.
that undoes what you did inside. And that's where, you know, that's where, again, it's another indication of two people involved. So one of them could have had the motive of, let's say, robbery, and the other one could have had some kind of personal motive. But there was a reason why they spent more time with her and spent more effort getting rid of her body than with Becky and John. And so if Becky was the target, yes, okay, she was shot in the head execution style. It could also be seen as a merciful way to put her out of her misery. You know, just shoot her in the head once and that's it. She's done. You know, it's instant. And that is not how it appears with Becky. You know, they spent the time with her to get rid of her body, to immolate her, to get rid of any indication that she was ever alive, you know? And I don't know that they completed that because, you know, I think they got interrupted. You know, it must have been a matter of minutes between the time she was lit on fire and the neighbor showed up, right? A matter of minutes, and that's what increases the chance that literally they were interrupted doing that.
I had hypothesized that she was lit on fire first based on the location of the gas can.
Well, what you never told me about location.
There's gas cans throughout the house, but there's one particular gas can that was very clearly out of place. There was the garage was pretty cluttered, but there was a walkway through the garage to the door, and one of the gas cans was in the walkway. Like a big 5-gallon plastic gas can, if that's what was used. I thought maybe they take it, the gas can, then they'll lit her first and then went. The timing throws that off a little bit, I think, because of, you know, when she was lit.
Yeah. Plus, I mean, leaving a gas can in the middle of the garage there when the house is on fire, they're going to make the assumption that it's going to eventually blow up and help destroy the house, right?
Mm-hmm.
We can't tell, obviously, whether that's the gas that was used in the wheelbarrow and on the stairwell. And the red circles up by the kitchen? I couldn't tell if they were in the garage or in the kitchen or both.
It was right in the entryway from the garage to the kitchen into the house.
Okay. So when you say there's gas cans all over the house, what do you mean by that?
There were 3 or 4 they found in the loft area and in the garage. I think there was 3 or 4 total that were found in the garage. They just had, you know, John was kind of a handyman. They had gas cans all over the place.
Right, but it was all in the garage where you would keep gas cans.
Yeah, there were none found in the actual house, right?
All right.
You know, they could have, they're plastic, so they could have melted. That's a possibility, but there was no remnants found that they believed was gas in the house. Do you have an idea of age or post-offense behavior or pre-offense behavior?
Well, pre-offense behavior would have been interaction with the victim and planning this. Negative interaction with the victim and then planning this. Post-offense, this is kind of a big deal. You know, a triple homicide, somebody who I don't believe was criminally sophisticated and experienced. I think that person would have evinced some, those persons would have evinced some, you know, pretty major psychological trauma and changes based on this. Unless the person was a stone cold psychopath who you know, they recover very quickly from extremes that, you know, those of us who are regular humans react in a very visible way when something this extreme happens, or when you cause something this extreme. And they would be, you know, very interested, as any fire setter would, in the results of what happened, and watching the news and making sure that they knew what was going on. You know, the smart thing to do would be to sort of lay low and be going about your life normally. But what could happen, because I think I see some immaturity here, what could happen is they might insert themselves to a degree into the investigation to find out, really to find out what the cops know, and to see whether or not they were on the radar. If the people that did it might also, you know, sort of want to stay apart for a while, whether that's to establish alibis or what, but, you know, if they were really smart, I'm thinking pre-offense, they might, you know, since there's no use for a cell phone up on the hill, right? Mm-hmm. They might separate their cell phones.
Right.
Leave one of them at their office or back at their home or whatever, and, you know, so that they can say that they were actually wherever the cell phone is, right?
Right.
In other words, there's no towers up on this hill, right?
Right.
So they don't have to worry about it pinging up there, but I would worry if they were both together, whatever, what is it, Highway 74?
Yeah.
They were both together on Highway 74 near the entrance where the last tower is, and then they disappear, and then they come back after these crimes were consummated, then, you know, that would be pretty damning evidence. But I'm just thinking, that was just a side thought.
Right. So what I thought was everything we talked about, I saw the, like you said, there was a lot of effort put into concealing the crime of John and Vicky, right? Burn the house down. Everything we talked about, and then, you know, as far as two people, they intended to go there and kill. And as you pointed out, there was steps made to conceal the crime of John and Vicky. So it would have been successfully if it weren't for the fact that, yeah, Becky's body burning, which was, as you put it, undid what they did in the house. I read that kind of opposite as you did, as that was where their focus was on John and Vicky. There's a known, I agree, this is a personal cause homicide. This is a known, there's a known relationship there, that there was this effort put in to try to conceal the fact that a crime was committed at all with them, which is why I lean towards Becky being unexpected, probably the interruption and an afterthought, that they, you know, the only reason she was lit on fire was because of, to cover up some forensics, which to me, when we add all those things up, the, my profile was, and really what I know it differs from yours. I'm really looking to see if you think it's plausible or if I'm just way out of line with it, that it's probably, our offender's probably someone, one of them at least, is law enforcement. I didn't think military so much, only because of the what appears to me to be knowledge of like emergency service response times, how fire moves, things of that nature, that it's probably someone in the, you know, a cop, a fireman, EMS, someone with a background in one of those that have been to a lot of scenes, because, you know, even if fires, cops go to fires also. They respond to them as well. So they, and so do EMS. So they all get lumped in there to me. I'd mentioned someone that maybe is an avid bird hunter or sport shooter or something, that they had these wrong rounds with them when they came out. And I leaned towards more someone on more on the mature side with some experience. A lot of that, some of the law enforcement said, but it's based on our differing hypotheses about why Becky was burned. If she was burned because they spent more time with her, that obviously I agree with you. If she was burned very quickly because of forensic evidence, it leans me towards someone who probably has some knowledge of, which again leans back towards the law enforcement type people, you know, they know that my hair or my skin's under her fingernails. My hairs could be on her body, light her on fire that way. It was, even though the scene looks like chaos, their forensic countermeasures they took were extremely successful. They went 10 years with the case being unsolved. And then when an arrest was made, and even through trial, it was really, the case was circumstantial at best in a stretch to get it. So there never was a smoking gun found on the crime scene. So whether it was intentional or unintentional, the forensic countermeasures were ultimately very effective. So yeah, I lean towards two people, one's in charge, sharper than the other one, probably with some kind of emergency services background and some knowledge of forensics, and then a lackey that's with them that isn't quite so sharp. I lean towards someone's head that someone who has had some kind of a violent history, or a psychopath, like you said, somebody who's not bothered by shooting three people to death. I still lean away towards Becky being the intended target because of how, if I'm mad at her and she's the reason I'm doing this, I kill her without any evidence of injury to her face, any injury to her head, injury to her throat. She's got potentially a gunshot wound to the center of body mass. It's a quick, not very personal kill to me compared to what we saw inside. So, and I know that differs greatly from your profile, but I guess what I'm looking for is, do you think that's out of line, or is it something that's plausible, or what are your thoughts?
No, well, what I said from the start, there's a point at which this case bifurcates, and, you know, and it's not clear completely whether Vicky or Becky was the target. I think we both rule out John because of the way he was kind of dispatched from a distance compared to the other two. But I am, you know, you make a real plausible argument. If the purpose was to come and kill the adults in the situation, you know, Vicky and John, and they were in the midst of that when Becky shows up to get her shirt because she had already left, it would probably mean that these killers would have been waiting, you know, in the wilderness there, waited for her to leave, and then went inside and did what they were going to do and got interrupted in the midst of that. And so at that point, there would have had to have been some sort of ulterior motive. If killing them was the ultimate motive, they've done an amazingly good job of hiding that. Very, very successful at hiding what that other motive might have been, because we just don't see it anywhere. And then Becky comes in, they have to now deal with her, and she could have gotten the focus of their rage because she wasn't supposed to be home. She wasn't supposed to be there, and now she screwed everything up. Let me give you another scenario. What if killing Mom and John was to punish her, but they didn't want to kill her? They wanted her to be around, maybe come running back to them, or to be there if they weren't together before, to be there to be the shoulder that she would cry on. And then she shows up in the middle of it. That would kind of screw up that plan. That would be something that would cause them to have to deal with her. She could have seen what was going on and run. And then now they have to do something. Now they have to kill her. And, you know, that becomes now their new task. And they didn't plan this part. And
right,
they get interrupted in the middle of it. And we see the results of it.
That's an interesting thought. And it brings a couple other suspects to mind, actually. But speaking of which, I'm going to run a few people by and just get your just kind of immediate reaction. I haven't dug into them as suspects, just know some basics about a few people. So as we move through a couple of these suspects, one thing that we didn't mention was in the notes, because you'd mentioned the possibility of some law enforcement background. There was also that pen that was found on the ground right near Becky's body, and it was a Riverside County Sheriff's Association pen. It was found when there were only three cops on scene. All the cops on scene were asked if they'd lost a pen. They all said no, which most of my audience thought, well, who knows if they lose a pen? I'm assuming it's the same for you when you were in the FBI, but for me in the fire department, you know if you lost your pen because it's part of your uniform. You have a pen that's you keep in the same place. It's the same pen all the time. You write your reports with it, everything. So you definitely know if you dropped a pen. So they say they didn't lose a pen. That pen's there. So that's just something to think about when I mention the fact that Vicky's ex-husband, who is the one that she owed, that owed her the $175,000 that they were fighting in court, and it sounded like he was losing and was going to have to pay her that, had just retired from the Riverside County Sheriff's Department. So he was a cop. So I'll let you chew on that for a minute.
Well, you know, I mean, he would be mature, though, I assume. And I would think he would be very forensically sophisticated, and he retired. I mean, he was a cop for a long time then. I would say he'd be very criminally sophisticated, too, you know, just because of what he was doing. So he doesn't fit that well. I mean, obviously, I would want to know where the hell he was that day. Do we have any idea?
No, I don't, because I try as best I can as I'm going through to hold off until I get through this part to really investigate. So I only know.
Well, find out where he was. If he was in the neighborhood, I would put him a couple of notches up. But, you know, so you're saying he's retired, but he might still be carrying around a Riverside County pen.
Well, it's the union pen, and you, with the, usually like with those unions, like when you retire from the fire department, you still maintain your membership in the IAFF. You're still a union member.
But if it was his pen, I would think it would be fairly easy to get his DNA off of it.
Right. Well, I do know from when we haven't got into forensics yet that they pulled profiles off of it, and it was tested against, there's a lot of this, the defendants that were arrested and the victims, and that was it, and never run through CODIS or tested against anyone else. So there is some forensics there. But yeah, we got a lot of a long way to go with him, but I saw it just caught my attention when you were going through the scene and you said that seemed like somebody that possibly had some police experience. And I know, and I'm not even, I wouldn't even say hypothesizing this yet, but as I'm just working through, like, how might that work with Becky, I would almost assume that if he had some involvement, that it would probably be maybe some of his friends that he had carry it out, or I don't know. It's hard to imagine a parent doing something like that to a child. But then, like, we just spent a couple weekends ago discussing in depth another case where parents seem to have very likely done some pretty grotesque things to a child after she was dead. So it can happen. I don't think it can be eliminated based on the fact that most people wouldn't, because we know that it can happen in certain instances.
And the hypothesis that I posed, that if Becky was actually the target, but not for murder, Becky was the target to suffer because her mother was taken out, then I don't know, that could, you know, if she came in and surprised these people, like, I guess under the scenario you're posing, it wouldn't be the actual father who carried it out. It would be somebody who was doing his bidding, but that's a pretty serious and elaborate scheme.
Right. Or, you know, it could be in a scenario like that. I could see a scenario where, you know, it was the father and someone that went in and it was, we're going to go kill them, light the house on fire. She's dead. I don't have to pay the money anymore. And that's it. And then they get interrupted by her daughter. Now he's faced with a daughter it seems like he didn't have much of a relationship with, just walked in and witnessed him murdering her mom. And then
now it's a real problem. Yeah.
Right. Just a possibility. But I agree with you. That is usually, we talk when we do a profile, then next step is to look at people's alibis.
I'll be very interested in finding out what his is. Right.
Then another obvious suspect is the boyfriend, or the ex-boyfriend, who had the girlfriend who had broke up with Becky back in January, who was supposed to go hiking with her that day. We know from him, he and his buddy worked at water park downtown, down in the valley. They only had 2 days left to work because it was their summer job, and they got fired that afternoon, or they got suspended, but it covered their last 2 days because after the water park shut down at six, they were riding down the slides without water on them. And so they got in trouble for that. And then they talked to her. There's phone evidence, which he told the story, and the phone evidence matches that they had talked back and forth a couple times, that she had called and called his buddy, and that they were together. And, he says they were out doing paintball and stuff down in the valley, and then he never went up for the hike. I don't see a motive there, but he's an obvious suspect.
Yeah, but again, you match him as a suspect against the outcome. I mean,
right.
What did he have against her parents? What did he have against her? Why now if that's him?
Yeah, and there was a change there, right? Because they had just, they seemed like they hadn't talked for a little while, and after she broke up with her boyfriend. Just
yeah, what about his new, her new girlfriend? His new girlfriend might be another story, which could be another reason why the wheelbarrow was used.
Mm-hmm.
As a practical thing to transport the body. But I just don't see with him, I mean, what's the point, a triple homicide because your ex-girlfriend started talking to you again?
Yeah, it's tough to imagine, especially for me, if we think that they parked the car down the road and came up to the scene with two guns.
To kill.
It's hard to make that
yeah, catch up. I'm not buying that, Bob. Sorry.
Yeah. And then so the guy that he was with all night, because they basically, he's his alibi, is his buddy with him. Post-offense, he ends up, the ex-boyfriend ends up marrying the girlfriend. He was planning on going to the military, ended up not doing that, and went to school to do heating and air conditioning and was an HVAC tech. The other guy did go to the military, ended up becoming an Army Ranger, and actually was a Medal of Valor winner in Afghanistan over the next few years. 10 years, that pass. And he also married his high school girlfriend from that time, shortly thereafter, after he went into the military. Don't have a lot of post-offense behavior on the dad, other than that, because he just wasn't really investigated. He was kind of out of the picture. Any concerns or anything with the post-offense of either of those two?
Nothing stands out, no. Right. I mean, if he the next day or week enlisted and got sent overseas, if it happened something like that quick and he's just trying to get out of town, yeah, maybe. But marrying your girlfriend and then going into the military months or years after that, just that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about immediately trying to adjust to change something because they're so freaked out about what they just did.
Right. When you're talking about, you see some immaturity, are you thinking like teenagers?
Well, I mean, what I'm saying is it could be somebody who's in their teens. It could be somebody who's early 20s, but that's what I'm talking about.
Okay.
Somebody who isn't thinking in terms of the severity and the extreme nature of this crime. This is like something like they didn't really, there isn't enough of a motive to justify this kind of extreme crime. And that is somebody who is more impulsive and immature. The planning clearly wasn't that sophisticated. And if something as simple as somebody leaving their t-shirt behind can screw up your crime, then you didn't plan very well. Nobody was looking out or confirming that she was at work or whatever.
Right. So the other suspects we have are, there's obviously the ex-boyfriend, which I haven't dug much into him. He was a couple years older than her, and she had broke up with him, I think, 2 days before this.
What was that breakup like?
I don't know. It's the friends were interviewed by police, and they just, it's one of these cases where you listen to the police interviews and you're just screaming because like, why didn't you ask that question? They broke up. Yeah, I think she broke up with him.
She broke up with him. But was this the kind of thing where they couldn't have been going out for more than, 8 months, right?
Right. Yeah, it was for a couple months, I think, through the summer.
Okay, so
yeah.
It wasn't a really long term. Was this the kind of thing where he love bombed her and, wanted to be with her all the time and was constantly all over her? What is the, why did she break up with him? What's the, right. So I would look into that, and if he's the kind of person who would do this, I would suspect that his pre-offense behavior was like that. Love bombing. Everything is amazing. You've changed my life. I want to be with you forever. That kind of extremism in order to, after a couple of months, that would mean that her breaking up with him caused him to do a triple homicide. That's pretty extreme behavior. So I don't think he would have had a criminal history in this, but either he has some serious traits and characteristics of a psychopath, or something's really, really messed up in his life. Something is really wrong with him, mentally. I would have to look at that.
And you'd expect to see some big changes in behavior after. And I haven't investigated him as a suspect yet, so I don't know if these things are happen, but I'd be looking for changes in behavior.
Yeah, I mean, I would think that if he's a stone cold psychopath, they recover like that. Best example would be, is it Bandersloot? I can't remember. Natalie Holloway's killer, who on the 5th anniversary killed another girl, and just moments afterwards just walked out with 2 empty coffee mugs to go get coffee, saying he's going to get coffee for his girlfriend.
Oh yeah, I know the case.
Comes back and finds her dead. Mm-hmm. Well, what he didn't realize is there's a camera right outside the door and he's the only one in and out, and she's right in there dead, but he thought immediately, okay, I can establish an alibi by saying I'm going out to buy some coffee for both of us. And I'm shocked that, look, I have another coffee for her. So clearly I couldn't have killed her. Well, that didn't work out so well for him.
Right.
But anyway, they recover so quickly. He's calm, cool, collected, out in public, not having a problem. You and I'd be sweating bullets, trying to figure out what the hell to do. Yeah. Psychopaths can think through that.
Yeah. So we'll look for that with him. We also have his cousin was one of Becky's best friends, was around her all the time, was talking to her. She'd go to his, when she'd get off her graveyard shift in the morning, she'd go to his house and spend the night. So she'd get off at 4 or 5 in the morning down in the valley. So instead of driving up home, she'd go to his house and crash there in the morning sometimes.
Was there anything going on between them?
Doesn't sound like romantically. I've heard, kind of rumors that I kind of get the impression that he's kind of a friend zoned kind of guy that, really cares a lot about her, but maybe she doesn't, Robert, who was the ex-boyfriend from back in January, was a friend of his. She dated him. She dated his cousin. She's kind of dating people around him, but never him.
Well, that would fit into what I said is in terms of somebody who might want to, this guy would have had to been pretty messed up, but wanting to take out the mom and father figure so that she would come running to him. If he's the friend that she cries on his shoulder, maybe that would be the way. That would be very deranged thinking, but it's a possibility. I'm not going to say it's a probability, but that is one possibility.
Yeah. And when you say he was, when you said that scenario, when I said someone popped in my mind, that was him, because I never really thought of him as much of a suspect, but that scenario was like, oh, if that's what happened, I don't know that that's what happened.
Well, where was he at the time? I'd look into that,
Yeah. And he was up at the crime scene by 8 o'clock that morning. He's actually, standing outside the crime scene. He was lived down in the valley, but either was staying up with a friend who lived up in Pinyon Pines or...
Wait. He was staying with somebody who lived in the neighborhood?
I'm trying to think right now because he...
Friends has people?
Yeah. Yeah.
Lived in the neighborhood.
In the neighborhood. And he could walk to his place where he was staying?
Right. Yeah. Things to consider, right?
Wouldn't have to drive away. Mm-hmm. Maybe saw her drive away.
I don't even want to.
I'm just asking. but maybe he could see her drive away, know that she's away on her way to work. And
his friend did live on Pena, but I don't know if he was there. I don't remember, or if I don't know if I even know yet if he was there yet at the time. But I'm gonna, the next thing I'm gonna tell you that I wasn't even gonna mention, the fire trucks on the way there said a small red pickup truck almost ran them off the road when they were responding to the fire, driving the opposite direction. And then like their lights, sirens going, and the guy air horn, the guy just kept blowing, and the tight road almost ran the truck off the road, driving this little red pickup truck. His buddy that lived up there drove a little red pickup truck, which we caught just through context. The listener caught in his interview. He's the friend is on Javier is his name. The one that's like the friend zoned or the one that's good friends with Becky. He's talking to the police up at the scene, and you hear the cop ask, whose red truck is that? And he says, oh, that's Nick's. His buddy Nick, who lives up on the scene, lives up in the neighborhood, but never confirmed by police if it was actually Nick's truck, or they never really pursued that angle. There's so many layers here that the Javier, the friend, his dad is the DA's investigator in the homicide unit. So
there's
a little hands-off approach to looking at him.
Yeah, that's a little bit of a conflict of interest, don't you think?
Mm-hmm. You'd think so. But he was never considered a suspect, so I guess they decided it wasn't. But that's...
Well, but not considering a suspect is a conflict of interest.
Right, yeah. Exactly. So there's him. There's the ex-boyfriend, the one she just broke up with. His roommate apparently didn't like Becky, like really didn't like her, and went to her work and got an altercation with her a couple days before this.
What was that about? What do you mean?
Yeah, I don't know what it's about, and I haven't been through again because I intentionally stayed back from that at this point. His interview to hear the explanation of it. I just heard that it happened through listening to some of the Denny's employees interviews.
Okay. All right. Well, you have a lot of people to look at. I'm afraid I haven't narrowed it down significantly for you because I still think this, you have to look at this with a bifurcated approach. And, but a couple of those people, like, you know, so dad kind of fits into your version of the profile, and the recent ex and this friend zone guy fits into mine.
Right. What's interesting about that is the two guys that were convicted of the crime.
Oh, there was a conviction.
Yeah, there's a conviction. I work wrongful convictions. Of course there was a conviction.
Well, you just kept saying there was an arrest. So I didn't.
The guys that were arrested and convicted were the two that worked at the water park, the ex-boyfriend from January that had been talking to her that was planning the hike. Those are the two that were ultimately arrested and convicted.
Wait, so not the recent broken up boyfriend, but
right.
The older boyfriend who had a new girlfriend?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Really?
Yeah, that's... That's why I took the case, that reaction you had right there. Now, there was, we'll be on, we're already been going for 3 hours. I'm not going to get into any more. There's more. There was a circumstantial case they built.
All right, well, let's do that another time.
All right. And with that, after 3 hours and technical difficulties and everything else, I think we're both pretty exhausted. So we'll go ahead and call this a night. But
Jim, yeah, I really appreciate you.
I'm surprised it just seems like, so the water park boys, wow, that's interesting.
Justice is an NBI Studios production and is distributed by Wondery. edited by Kelly Barron's Brink and sound engineered by Shane Yoder. All music for the show was created, composed, and scored by PutThemInASong.com, who also mixed and mastered this episode. All of our fonts across all of our logos and banners were created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. You can find more of Tate's work on Etsy. Thank you to Katie Ross of CreatedInTandem.com for designing, creating, managing, and maintaining our website, TruthAndJusticePod.com, where you can view all photos and documents discussed in every episode. And a big thank you to our transcription team, Pamela Westby, Kathy McElhaney, Kay Woodyomnik, Ginger Fiola, Erica Cantor, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Ford, Courtney Wimberly, and Melissa Cardenas. And as always, thank you to all of you for all of your engagement and support. If you like the show and you'd like to support us, you can do so in several ways. To financially support the show, the best thing you can do is just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. You'll not only be supporting the show, but you'll get something in return. On Patreon, you can pledge as little as $3 a month, and we have reward levels. For just $5 a month, you get access to ad-free versions of all of our episodes and behind-the-scenes bonus video content every week. Then other reward levels include t-shirts, hats, and even the opportunity to co-host one of our Friday follow-up episodes. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. You can also do us a huge favor by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. And lastly, you can always support us by supporting the brands that sponsor this program. If you have a new case you'd like us to consider for future seasons, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. And the most important thing that you can do is to engage in our investigations. You can keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the Truth and Justice Podcast fans page on Facebook. And for all you tweeters out there, you can connect with us on Twitter @TruthJusticePod. And I can be found personally on all forms of social media @BobRuffTruth. And don't forget that we always have our 24/7 voicemail line open for questions, comments, or tips on our cases. That phone number is 269-224-2833. However you do it, stay engaged, stay in touch. But as for now, I'm signing off. I'm Bob Ruff, and this has been Truth and Justice.